From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. In just over a year, you might sit down, turn on your TV, and find nothing to watch. Literally. That's what some consumer advocates are afraid of. And they say the electronics industry may be stoking that fear to make people spend more money than they need to prepare for the transition to digital television. Critics say the government, and especially the Federal Communications Commission, should do more to make sure Americans know what's coming. Joel Rose has the second part of our series on the challenges facing the FCC.
If you're one of those people who still has what they used to call a rabbit ear antenna on the back of your TV, or even better, a coat hanger where the antenna used to be, federal officials have something to tell you. So they held a press conference last week at a Best Buy in Washington, D.C.
Everyone, we're going to also do a demonstration over here on the right-hand side of the converter boxes.
The head of the National Association of Broadcasters was there. So was a vice president from Best Buy and FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. They were all eager to have their pictures taken with the digital converter boxes, which should be in stores next week. People with analog TVs will need those if they're still going to get signals over the air. U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez was there, too. He explained that the converter boxes are just one option for consumers.
The second option is to connect to cable or satellite service. And the third option is to buy a TV with a digital tuner.
But all of those options will cost consumers money for something they currently get for free if they're watching over the air. Digital TV signals will be sharper and will offer viewers more choices. But that's not why Congress mandated the switch to digital. That has more to do with freeing up valuable space on the airwaves. Congress set the date for the transition, but Joel Kelsey of Consumers Union says it provided almost no money to let people know about the switch.
You see the federal government relying a lot on manufacturers, broadcasters, cable companies, satellite companies, nonprofits to get the word out. And because there's so many different people that come at the transition with so many different types of agenda, consumers are very confused about whether they're affected, what they need to do to prepare for the digital transition.
There are about 20 million households in America that only get their television over the free airwaves. A poll commissioned by the National Association of Broadcasters found that almost 4 in 5 Americans have heard about the impending transition to digital. But another poll by Consumers Union found that 3/4 of the people it surveyed were wrong about what they have to do to get ready. Activists say those at the greatest risk of losing TV reception are rural viewers, those who don't speak English as a first language, and the elderly. Linda Riley is the communications director at the Philadelphia Corporation for Aging. She says a representative from the Federal Communications Commission called recently, offering to send her information about the transition.
And I said, "That's wonderful." And he said, "Well, I can give you some packets. How many would you need?" And I said, "Well, there's 250,000 people over the age of 60 in the city of Philadelphia." And he said, "Well, I can give you 50 packets.
50, 5-0.
Yeah. So I scaled back my kind of ambitions for this.
In the absence of any large-scale government effort, some seniors are taking it upon themselves to spread the word about the digital transition. At Journey's Way, a community center for people 55 and older in northwest Philadelphia, retired custodian Don Hendrickson is doing his part.
The more information you can provide for people, the better off it is for everybody.
Hendrickson was explaining the nuances of a government coupon program to his friends. Congress has set aside up to $1.5 billion to help subsidize the cost of those digital converter boxes. But Hendrickson says that if people don't know about the coupons, they won't know to ask for them. And he's worried that seniors will end up buying a new TV or cable subscription they don't really need.
If they say, "You need to buy this TV now because this is coming," you know, it's going to frighten people. And it's going to say, "Okay, you know, I'd better do this."
Consumer activists say leaving the information campaign in the hands of industry is a bit like letting the proverbial fox guard the hen house. But retailers insist they want people to know about the coupon program, and they are stocking the converter boxes. Mark Pearl is the founder of the Consumer Electronics Retailers Coalition.
Yes, we'd love to sell new televisions to people, but these people are on a fixed income. And that's why all of us together are trying to make sure that the people come in and know what their choices are.
A year ago, Pearl helped organize retailers, broadcasters, and others into a DTV coalition, which now has more than 200 members. Pearl says they've tried to educate consumers through websites and public service announcements on TV.
Television as you know it is about to change. By law, the old method of transmitting TV signals, known as analog, must switch to new digital technology.
The transition to digital TV is already underway in the United Kingdom, and it's being handled differently. Everybody's
talking at me. Look for the digital tick when converting your old TV or buying new TV equipment. It means it's ready for the digital switchover.
The switchover, as the Brits call it, is happening at different times in different regions. And there's one single nonprofit called Digital UK that's in charge of everything. Spokesman John Steele says Digital UK staffers even make house calls to viewers who need the most help.
People who are older and often socially isolated, so they don't maybe have their family living nearby, they're unsure where to go to get help. And I think those are the people we tend to worry about most, and those are the people who got, you know, the most benefit from the range of help that was put in place.
Providing that help isn't cheap. The budget for Digital UK's public education program alone is £200 million, almost $400 million US dollars. That's in a country one-fifth the size of ours. By contrast, the U.S. Congress has allocated less than $10 million for the public education program here. Industry groups say they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on their own.
It is different organizations and groups that are trying to get various messages across, and no one is really coordinating this message.
Mark Goldstein at the Government Accountability Office looked at the situation. Goldstein concluded that the U.S. should have one single plan for the digital TV transition. And the GAO issued a report saying the best agency to craft that plan is the Federal Communications Commission.
We explained that we felt that it was their job as the nation's regulator of the airwaves, that if anyone was in a position to take stronger action to ensure a smooth transition, they were the logical entity. But they did not agree with us.
FCC Chairman Kevin Martin did not grant an interview for this story. The commission recently asked for $20 million for public education in the president's budget for the coming fiscal year. At last week's photo op at the Best Buy, Martin pointed out that the commission has asked Congress for money before.
There were several years that we had asked for money for education efforts, and Congress didn't give us any. If Congress gives us additional resources, then we will utilize those for an education efforts as well.
But it's the Commerce Department, not the FCC, that's in charge of the Converter Box coupon program. And Joel Kelsey of the Consumers Union suspects there's a reason no single government agency is rushing to lead the charge.
There's a lot of anticipated problems and consumer strife that's going to exist out there. No one really wants to be behind it. No one wants to pick up the ball and take charge because they don't want to have the blame levied on them.
Conveniently, there will also be a new president in the White House in February of 2009. And the only thing harder than getting a TV signal with your old rabbit ears may be finding someone to blame when you can't. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Back now with Day to Day. Here's an endeavor that seems doomed from the start, an anthology in book form of blogs. First of all, there's the sheer volume. There are some 15 million active blogs worldwide. And second, and this is what my guest will hopefully explain, how do you pin down or capture a blog in a book? Isn't a blog's very identity wrapped up in its internet form? Sarah Boxer is the author of the new book, Ultimate Blogs, Masterworks from the Wild Web. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What prompted you to try to pin down this unruly beast?
Well, it was kind of a challenge. I was wondering, well, what is it about these things that is so hard to pin down and is so hard to get into print? And so it became a challenge and a kind of an experiment in finding out what is left of a blog when you take away the links and you take away the speed and just the interactivity.
Right, the kind of conversation, because when you're you're reading a blog, you're supposed to be participating in a way, at least, you know, if you're not commenting on it, sort of in your mind, having a conversation with the blogger.
Right. Any blog is, well, most blogs, I should say, are really porous in one way or another to the rest of the web, whether it's because they're referring to other articles that are written or whether it's because they have a comment section. Or with some of them, it has to do with scrolling. Just the act of scrolling affects how they're written. For instance, there's a fashion blog.
I know what you're talking about. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's great. It's GoFug, F-U-G, yourself. It's two women who are extremely snarky about the bad fashion choices that celebrities make. They are hilarious, but one of the things that is very important about how the blog works is that often the humor is what I would call scroll humor, where you have to get to the bottom of the picture. You work your way down in the text, and then you see, like, the punchline is the shoes at the bottom of the screen, and it all kind of comes together. That's a great example of something that is extremely hard to capture.
So how did you capture it?
Well, I looked and looked, and there are qualities about blogs, I think, that remain even when they are in print, and that is the sort of the snarkiness, the fierceness, the openness, the public and private mix, the nastiness. And there's just a certain kind of humor that is still there even when you take away the links and the timeliness. And I think there really is something that I would call bloggy writing that is distinctive.
There's definitely a tone that a lot of blogs share, and it is a snarky tone. Why is that the default blog tone?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with what gets people's attention. In print publications, you already have your audience. But if you write a blog and you don't have a reputation, how do you get noticed? And one of the ways that you do it is by attacking famous people, by attacking famous newspapers, by going after something that will catch someone's attention. And I think it's sort of survival of the meanest in a certain way. It's not just meanness, though. It's a certain kind of wit.
What's your favorite personal blog that you saw out there? One that's really reveals it all and is strangely like compelling.
Oh, boy. It goes by the name ABB. I'm not sure I can say this on the air.
Angry Black Rhymes with Witch.
Yes, that's okay. The one. That's terrific. Eurotrash, I think, is amazing. These are people who are sort of writing about their own lives, or you can get the feel of who they are anyway. Julia Here Be Hippogriffs is about a woman going through infertility trouble. And they're great storytellers, all of those people. That's another thing that I think I realized once I had my collection, is that this is one of the things that I think bloggers who work well in a book do well, is tell stories, just amazing stories from all corners of the globe, and very personal things that have very much to do with public life or where they are in the world.
So it sounds like the form hasn't really changed the essential truth of these things, and that is a good story is a good story, and good writing is good writing no matter where you find it.
Right, that's true, although it's unlikely I would have found these things if it weren't for the blogosphere. And I am not sure that they would have found their way into anybody's home without the blogosphere existing. I'm not sure these people would have had a place to do what they do. Yes, it is storytelling, but there is something about the way they write that is peculiar to the web, I think.
Did it ever cross your mind that maybe you should have blogged this book rather than?
Not for a minute. I mean, this is one thing that I wrote in my introduction, I don't have a blogging bone in my body, and that remains true. I have huge respect for these people. I mean, they are out there in a way that is just phenomenally frightening to me.
What do you mean by frightening?
I mean, there are people who tell stories, just extremely intimate stories. Eurotrash, for instance, telling very intimate stories about her father, her mother's death, her sort of abuse by an older man as a kid. I mean, just kind of out there. I mean, it's just very, very personal in certain cases.
So frightening when you imagine yourself doing it, but I wonder if they see it as frightening.
I don't think that they do, actually. I mean, I think it's a different generation, and I think the frightening thing for a lot of bloggers is to not have a presence on the web. They just cannot imagine it. It's like almost not existing. And I think for many of them, that's the thing. They exist because they blog.
Some people who are less generous than you would say they're just, you know, self-indulgent exhibitionists.
Well, that too. But I think I do think that there's more to it. I just think it's a whole different way of being.
Sarah Boxer is the author of the new book. It's called Ultimate Blogs, Masterworks from the Wild Web. Sarah Boxer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can find links to all the blogs in Sarah Boxer's book at npr.org.
NPR's business news starts with another Black Day for BlackBerry. Millions of people who use the popular wireless device are wondering what happened. Email service delivered over the handheld gadget crashed for several hours yesterday, and the Canadian company that makes BlackBerries still isn't saying why. The outage affected many of BlackBerry's 12 million customers. It's the second outage in less than a year. Analysts say it could damage BlackBerry's reputation for reliability and give an edge to rivals.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand. If you had a guess, which would you say is smarter, an ear of corn or a caterpillar, if you had a guess? Well, for a while it was the corn, which has been genetically engineered to kill insects that want to eat it. Cotton, too, has been altered. Now, though, it looks like the caterpillar has learned some lessons. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
The crops contain a gene that was extracted from an insect-killing microbe called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT. So the genetically engineered corn and cotton are often called BT crops. When they first went on the market about 10 years ago, Bruce Tabashnik from the University of Arizona thought they might not work for long.
I thought we might see resistance to BT crops in 5 years or less.
It took twice as long as expected, but Tabashnik says he's now seen the first case of resistance in a caterpillar called the bollworm.
It's a pest in cotton, corn, and many other crops. It eats many different crops.
The evidence comes from another group of researchers at the University of Arkansas. Those scientists have been collecting bollworms and other pests from cotton fields in Mississippi and Arkansas. And some of the bollworms collected in recent years have been able to survive much higher doses of the BT poison in laboratory experiments. Tabashnik published his analysis in the current issue of Nature Biotechnology. In an odd twist, though, the scientists in Arkansas who actually collected those bollworms and tested them aren't so sure the resistance is all that new. They say those hardy insects may have been living in cotton fields all along. Scientists just happen to find them now. In any case, if more bollworms are surviving on BT cotton, farmers haven't yet noticed much practical effect. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
The dealing between Microsoft and Yahoo is still going on with new intensity. Earlier today, Yahoo formally rejected Microsoft's $44.6 billion takeover bid. Yahoo told Microsoft that its $31 per share offer substantially undervalues the company. Microsoft, in turn, called Yahoo's rejection of the offer unfortunate. As NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports, the ball is now clearly in Microsoft's court.
No one thought Microsoft's unsolicited bid for Yahoo would be accepted without a fight, and today's response was entirely predictable. So what happens next? Option one, Microsoft could raise its price. The original offer represented a 62% premium over the share price at the time. That sounds pretty good, but Microsoft reportedly offered Yahoo a much richer deal, about $40 a share last year. And Mark Mahaney of Citigroup says if Microsoft believes it needs Yahoo, it will have to pay more than its current offer.
If they're really serious about succeeding in online advertising and putting down a $45 billion bid for Yahoo has got to be, there's no better evidence that they're serious about this, then I don't think Microsoft can afford to accept a no on a 31 bid. I think they would have to counter with a higher price.
Another option for Microsoft is this. While it's not saying anything publicly, Microsoft is considering an end run around the Yahoo board of directors, taking its case directly to Yahoo shareholders and getting them to sell Microsoft their shares. Charlene Lee of Forrester Research explains.
And if I can own enough shares on the public market to have a majority of the shares, I can then have majority voting on the board. I can own the board of directors, kick out the current board of directors and put my own executives in place.
They would then approve Microsoft's takeover of Yahoo. Microsoft has until mid-March to nominate its own slate of directors. But Charlene Lee says Yahoo has made it very clear that it wants to remain independent, or at the very least, stay out of Microsoft's hands.
This is a company who prides itself as one of the foundations of the Internet. The founder is at the helm. He doesn't want to see this going to a company that they don't have a lot of respect for. They don't think that Microsoft has very good Internet smarts and don't really want to be owned by a company like that.
Yahoo could also try to blunt Microsoft's effort by exercising an anti-takeover device known as a poison pill. Yahoo would issue more stock, making a buyout too expensive for Microsoft to pull off. Behind the scenes, there is lots of maneuvering. Google offered to help Yahoo fend off Microsoft's offer with an advertising alliance with Yahoo. Still another possibility, some kind of deal between Yahoo and AOL's online division. Time Warner may be happy to sell that off. But all these deals would prompt antitrust scrutiny, and no final resolution is expected anytime soon. Indeed, the battle over what companies will survive in the Internet search and advertising industry is just getting started. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
There's a fight brewing in cyberspace. Next week, new rules go into effect on eBay. The site will be changing its fee system, instituting a 3-week hold on some funds sent through PayPal, and banning sellers from leaving negative feedback on buyers. And that's got some eBay sellers talking boycott. Thousands of them are walking the e-picket line, writing emails, promising not to sell anything for the week of February 18th, and producing videos on YouTube urging solidarity. A 2006 seller strike over higher fees didn't have much of an effect, but that hasn't stopped the online outrage. Here's how you can tell. Many eBay sellers are so mad, they're typing in all caps. It's All Things Considered.